If this thing is built, it will be a miracle to behold.
One of science's biggest promises.
It would be like the Wright brothers moment.
Governments, spies, billion-dollar investments, and scientific rivalries.
The control that's required is rivaled only by what God did in creating the universe.
Will quantum computers change everything? I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you remember hearing about those training and re-education camps from the Xinjiang region of far western China? The ones where mostly ethnic Uyghurs were sent, usually without trial or legal recourse. About 5 years ago, they were in the news a lot. Now, not so much. But people are still being held there, in secrecy and against their will. In 2018, this happened to Yalkun Uliul's family. His father disappeared without warning, and he hasn't heard a word from him since. Yalkun Uliul is a Uyghur man from the Xinjiang region in far western China. He's also a researcher for Human Rights Watch and joins me now. Welcome, Yalkun.
Thank you for having me.
When did you first realize something had seriously gone wrong with your father, Mehmet?
I have to roll back a bit. I went back home first in 2016 when the Chinese government started, on the eve of the mass incarceration and arbitrary detention of up to 1 million Uyghurs, and later sentencing of another 500,000 to long prison terms without due process. So I was just a random international student who was studying in Turkey, and I went back home in 2016. It was Ramadan. And I felt something was off because at mosques, there were, you know, devices that required people to scan their IDs, which was not there when I went back in 2014, for instance. So I was like, no, I'm not going to scan my ID. It was Ramadan. I didn't go to any Taraweeh. I didn't go to even Friday Jumu'ah prayer. I only went to Eid prayer, which was very weird for someone like me who are from a conservative background and who happens to be growing up around the community, around the mosque, around the thriving, you know, life that I once had. And I also realized, like, my cousins who used to have just beards like yours didn't have them anymore. They were forced to shave. And then I realized, oh, okay, this is different. And then first person from my wider family disappeared in September 2016 into one of the things that we call political education camps, which basically locks up Uyghurs for having ideological viruses. And I only wish it was only about my family or my father, but there are only a few among the hundreds and thousands of Uyghurs who are affected by this mass incarceration in my homeland.
Okay, so it's not a temporary loss of contact you've had with him, right?
So basically my father disappeared in 2018, all of a sudden, without a word. I tried to trace him. I just couldn't communicate with anyone. Nobody really replied to my message. And I joined, you know, hundreds and thousands of Uyghurs in the diaspora searching for their loved ones. It took me about 2 years to trace him to a political education camp in my hometown, Qumul. And then only after 2 years, I was able to confirm that he's sentenced to 16 years imprisonment, along with my uncle, who's now serving life, another one who's serving 20, another one who's serving 25. And I can count, like, countless Uyghurs, not only my family, but university professors, editors, writers, artists, musicians, imams, you know, community leaders, simply for their identity for being Uyghur. So, when we talk about, you know, specific cases of arbitrary detention or political imprisonment, we often think it is an individual story, but my story is not an individual one.
Right. So terms like arbitrary detention, they can sound a little abstract to people outside of Xinjiang. Could you explain to us what that actually means?
Yeah, for the Uyghurs, basically, you know, when a government comes and detain you without giving you a notice, a ground for their detention. And, you know, when they don't give the reason why you are being detained and when they do not communicate that to your family, they do not provide whereabouts of you, for instance, in the case of enforced disappearances. So basically, a lot of people just vanished.
Well, was your father an obvious case or an obvious target for this?
Oh, no, he was not. He was a university graduate who studied business administration in the 80s, former civil servant, later established his own business. And he was based in Guangzhou, doing a successful business exporting fruits from our homeland to 8 other countries in Southeast Asia, all distributing them to other provinces in China. He spoke good Mandarin. He spoke good Cantonese. He was just a random guy you would bump into on streets of my homeland with a very humble smile and a handsome face. So when people often ask me, why do you think your father was the case? And then I also ask them back, what was the crime of Professor Ilham Tohti of economics, who was an established economist who tried to advocate for a better relationship between Uyghurs and Han Chinese? What was the crime of Rahila Dawood, an anthropologist at Xinjiang University, who educated a lot of people about Uyghur culture and history? What was the crime of Yalqin Rozi, who was the editor of Uyghur textbooks once the government permitted and distributed in the curriculum? None of them are criminals, and none of them were obvious cases.
So one thing that stands out is how difficult it is to get reliable information out of Xinjiang, right? How much does secrecy itself become part of this system of control?
So when we call secrecy, it means that Chinese government initially denied the existence of such detention facilities. Only after international attention and mass evidence of satellite imagery of massive expansion of arbitrary detention centers or political education camps, then they tried to whitewash it by calling it vocational training centers. Then we ask the same question. Why would a person like my father, who was a successful businessman running a successful business with a university degree, who speaks perfect Mandarin and probably Cantonese, what kind of vocational training would he need? Or what kind of vocational training would a professor or an imam or a tradesman or, any random farmer on just minding his own business would need to such a degree where they had to hide and build up those mass detention centers? So for the Chinese government, they did not only, detain people, imprison them, erase Uyghur culture and identity. They also blocked the whole region for access. Mm. By access, I mean they did not allow UN experts or other independent investigators to have unfettered access to the region. If you look at the UN report, landmark report published in 2022, concluding that violations in the region may amount to international crimes, in particular crimes against humanity, they rely a lot on publicly available information and testimonies in the diaspora because they didn't have access, unfettered access to the region.
Could you tell me a little bit about what it's like to, say, contact relatives outside of Xinjiang, particularly overseas? Using something like WhatsApp can become dangerous for some people. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, Chinese government also deploys a mass surveillance system, mm-hmm. very sophisticated, platforms to track everybody's everyday activity and detect, suspicious behaviors, such as having a VPN to connect websites abroad or having a WhatsApp on their phone or contacting someone abroad or having a phone call with them having been to a sensitive country like Turkey or Central Asia, then the Chinese government flags you as suspicious individual and you may be subjected to detention. So when I try to call my loved ones back home, my grandparents, for instance, before they pass away, the last time they pick up my phone was during 1/8 celebration back in, I think, 2017. They pick up the phone, they heard my voice, and they say, "Do not call us again." They hung off. Wow. Because me calling them and trying to talk to them can result in them being detained or worse, imprisoned. So, no, it's not only about arbitrarily detaining people. It's not only about mass incarceration that amounts to crimes against humanity. There are also elements of mass surveillance with high technology, even with the AI, and also forced labor of Uyghurs. There's family separation, and there are well-evidenced of reproductive rights violations. Researchers have found about forced sterilization of Uyghur women, for instance. So if you, to take that all, it is about you know, going after a whole group of people for their identity, culture, and distinct historical heritage. You earlier, before the interview, asked about my surname. It means, it is Uluyol, right? And Human Rights Watch documented hundreds of Uyghur village names changed by the Chinese government with historical names and changed to something more, in line with CCP propaganda and naming. So basically, my village name changed in 2019. Now, we don't have somewhere called Uluyol, which I carry in my surname.
Right. Well, you've also written about people having to live two parallel lives, one public and obedient, the other, you know, secret and fearful. Could you explain a little bit about that?
You have to look very obedient. I don't tell
this. I say that means no beard.
Yeah, exactly. I don't have many anyway, so.
I'd be
so
in trouble.
It means that, like, I have to hide certain things. I have to hide, for instance, that I fasted. I had to pretend that I go to the shop next door between breaks so that I pretend that I'm buying something and then only to throw away to the bin so that people would see me buying something to eat, meaning that they will not be suspicious about my fasting. Or, let's say, I joined my glorious motherland CCP praising competition when I was a kid. Teachers were like, oh, there's a bilingual speech competition that you have to praise the great motherland and you have to recite that in Uyghur and Chinese. Let's see how far you go. And I won a prize for that. So from the outside, when you look at my speech, you will see, oh my God, what a patriotic young boy who dedicated his life to the great motherland. But if you look inside me, there's something distinct. There's something that reminds me that I am different, I am treated different, and what I am saying is quite performative.
So the youth in Xinjiang, would you say a lot of the Uyghur population, the young Uyghur population, they no longer speak their mother tongue, or a lot of them are speaking it far less because of this influence from the CCP?
Yes. We have seen an escalation in the assimilationist policies in the region, and a significant departure from previous policies that, you know, regulations enacted in 1980s, which grants autonomous rights and grants minority populations or minority nationalities the right to learn their own mother tongue at schools. I am one of the last generation of Uyghurs who actually had the lucky period where we studied everything in Uyghur. After me, it's either bilingual or fully Chinese. Now, if you go on streets of Urumqi, people, you know, children on street talk to each other in Mandarin. So that is how it is like in the Uyghur region, in Tibetan areas, and in other parts of the China where the Chinese Communist Party perceives distinct identity, culture, religion, and probably anything that is not in line with CCP as a threat.
Well, a few years ago, I recall this stuff being all over the news, right? But over the last 5 or 6 years, I've noticed that it's started to fade out. Why is it that we're not discussing detention camps in Xinjiang internationally anymore?
The international attention on Uyghurs were there, as you said. And it's fading away, not only because we shift our attention from one atrocity to another, but at the same time, the Chinese government is now trying to whitewash its crimes against humanity, against Uyghurs. They're not only arranging diplomatic propaganda tours or tours for media to, you know, show the happy, dancing, exotic Uyghur life in a Disneyland-like city centers while not allowing them to independently visit elsewhere without government control. And one last thing I do want to emphasize is that Uyghur people were not that much known 15 years ago, when I first came abroad, almost nobody really knew who I was. I had to explain who Uyghurs are, but now almost everybody knows. Not because of our rich culture, not because of our delicious food, not because of our humble hospitality, or not because of our beautiful landscape or tourist attractions, but because of atrocity crimes the Chinese government committed against my people. And I am proving that we are a great people, not only the victims, but also a people with history, with culture, with language, with religion, with conviction, and something to contribute to the world.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. Yalcun Uliol is a researcher for Human Rights Watch.
Thank you very much for hosting me.
Assassins is hosted by me, Aslan Pahari. Hannah Jose is the producer. Sound design by Emrys Cronin. Supervising producer is Kyla Slaven. Executive producers are Joel Werner, Eric George, and Jessica Ratburn. As well as listening to Assassins, you can watch full episodes of the show on YouTube and Spotify. Those videos are shot and edited by Tejas Bhatt and Dylan Bien. If there's an assassination you'd like us to cover on the show, please email us, assassins@abc.net.au. I hope to hear from you soon, my friend.